Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The United States is in deep debt. We are now using credit cards to pay for things like food and gas and even our monthly bills. The average student loan debt hovers around $25,000. The average car loan is more than about $27,000. According to the Federal Reserve Bank, Americans collectively owe $2.5 trillion in consumer debt. If you throw in mortgage loans, that number shoots up to $11.5 trillion. The average American has $15,000 in credit card debt alone. So how do we explain high personal debt? How has the current financial crisis changed the nature of consumer debt? And how have Americans' debt patterns changed over time? In the new book, Borrow, The American Way of Debt, one of today's guests, Lewis Hyman, examines the rise of consumer debt and how it has altered our culture and our economy. Lewis Hyman is assistant professor of history in Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations, and he joins us from New York. Hi, Lewis. Welcome to the show.
Here.
Nice to have you. We are also joined by Gary Rivlin, special correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. Gary is the author of 5 books, including his latest, Broke USA, From Pawn Shops to Poverty, Inc., How the Working Poor Became Big Business. Over the past 8 months, Gary has been writing about lobbying spending by banks and debt collectors in the U.S. According to a report that just came out by the Fed, the number of people being pursued by debt collectors has doubled over the past decade. Hi, Gary. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Ruth.
So, Lewis, why don't we start off with you? $15,000 in credit card debt for the average American. When we talk about consumer debt, what kind of debt are we specifically referring to?
Well, usually we mean credit card debt, car debt, and lately we've been including mortgage debt and student loans in that as well. Of course, before the crisis, student loans and mortgage debt were considered good debt, something we didn't mix in with that naughty credit card debt. So I think that the way we even categorize debt has changed in the past few years. Of course, those categories have changed before as well.
Because I am hearing a lot of students say they have no choice but to put their school bills on their credit cards.
Sure. I mean, I think that a lot of students are facing, particularly if they are non-traditional students, people who are, you know, not 18 and going to four-year colleges. They're facing a lot of challenges that certainly earlier generations did not.
And Gary, what's interesting, what I've been seeing in the news over the past week is that spending is up, and you're hearing this kind of spun as a positive thing. But I'm wondering, is spending up because people have money, or is spending up because people have no choice but to charge things like food and gas?
Exactly. There's something kind of twisted whenever I hear about, oh, more debt might be good for the economy. I mean, to me, there's a profound difference between consumer spending, which is good for the economy, even if some of us think that we're, you know, over-consuming, buying too many toys, that's a judgment, versus consumer spending that puts people more into debt. What I fear is that a lot of debt isn't the person splurging on a flat-screen TV they can't afford, though that, of course, happens. But, in fact, wages of the bottom 50% have stagnated over the last two or three decades, while meanwhile the prices of everything from rent, mortgage, insurance, heating oil, etc., goes up. And it's harder and harder to make ends meet. So you are putting essential expenses on your credit card. So, to me, consumer spending in the economy, that's one category. Debt and the economy is a completely different category.
What are your thoughts on this, Lewis? Because that's one of the main points in your book, that you say that our borrowing patterns really aren't much different from our grandparents, but our wages are stagnant, things are much more expensive, and that's why we're having a harder time paying these debts back.
Yeah, no matter what your grandparents tell you, they borrowed money. They borrowed for their FHA loans in the suburbs, they borrowed for their big fin cars, they even borrowed at department stores and their charge accounts. Borrowing was everywhere. What's different about that post-war period and today is, of course, that their economy was growing, that wages were going up fantastically, and they were able to pay back what they borrowed in the future. And I agree that today's borrowing is more compulsory as we watch the end of all those uninsured people losing their checks every month, we're seeing them put it on their credit cards. So these kinds of things are interconnected. You can't talk about debt without talking about work.
So, and to me, another difference between the last 10, 20 years and debt and, you know, our grandparents' generation is there's a more predatory side than there was back then. I mean, there's a long-time company having to go out of business after the crash, but Household Finance. And for decades, it was a really good company, working-class people who couldn't get money to buy a refrigerator, a car, whatever they needed, could get a small loan. They paid a lot, 15% interest, let's say. But there weren't all these fees. There wasn't this predatory side. Household Finance morphed into a very different company. I mean, such a nasty company that they had to pay $500 million to the attorney generals around the country to settle fraud suits, where they were pursuing people. They were luring them into more expensive loans that were actually destructive if the people really understood. You know, the subprime credit card, that's a relatively new creation. That became huge in the 80s and 90s, where there were fee-harvesting cards, where you could get people so desperate for credit that they'd pay a $100 application fee, a $75 activation fee, and then $20 a month. And meanwhile, they're only getting a $300 limit. Most of it is going to their fees. So there's been new creations, the payday loan, et cetera, in the last 10, 20 years that have added a predatory element to credit.
And I'd love to talk more about the predatory element later in the show and really talk about how this industry is regulated or not. How many companies are we talking about here? But Lewis, I'd like to ask you the same question that Gary addressed. How do you see what we're facing right now and how this is being reported in the media? Are people spending more because they have more money or because they have no choice but to put the basics on their credit cards?
My impression is that they don't have any choice. My impression is that, you know, we look at how people are earning money and whether they have jobs, and certainly the number of jobs has gone back up, or at least the unemployment rates have gone down, you know, which could be different if people are structurally out of the workforce. But people are borrowing to make ends meet. People are not borrowing for big TV sets and bling. They're paying for medical bills they didn't expect. They're paying for things that they couldn't, their rent. They're paying for all kinds of unanticipated expenses. And I think that is what we're seeing now. And the fact that more money is being lent means that, once again, the people who are lending the money and the people who are investing in consumer debt think it's a good use of their money. It'll be profitable again. And I think that's exactly what we're seeing, that this turn to profitable lending is what's so transformative in the 20th century.
Elaborate on that, profitable lending.
So in the 19th century, of course, there was lots of debt everywhere. There was mortgage debt for farms. But for consumers, it was very difficult to get a loan. Lenders did not want to give you money. If you went to your local grocery store, you might be able to get a loan, or you might be able to put the groceries on a charge account, but the lender didn't want to do it. The retailer didn't want to do it because it was not profitable. They didn't make any money lending to consumers. What changes after World War I is the development of a whole industry that profitably lend. Household Finance Corporation was part of that as one of the first small loan lenders. They're actually the very first small loan company to have an IPO, unfortunately, in 1929. But they were part of this revolution that enabled people to borrow not from loan sharks, not from grocers, not from their brother or cousin, but directly from a business. And it's in that moment in the 1920s when lending becomes profitable. And that only accelerates in the 1980s when you have the rise of securitization.
And Gary, in your book, you point out that there was a big rise in these companies lending to people who they knew couldn't afford the credit card or the multiple credit cards, really kind of going after low-income communities.
Right. So to break it into two, though, to stick with mortgages, home loans. Something else that happened in the 1980s, at the start of the 1980s, is the federal government lifted restrictions, lifted caps on the interest rates that people would have to pay for mortgages. In most states back then, there was a state-by-state cap. Could have been 10% a year on your mortgage, 12%, 15% on your mortgage. And the federal government said, no, states, you don't have that power anymore. And a second thing happened is they allowed for higher fees, more creative, interest-only, those kind of mortgages. And so you had a company like Household, a company that for a long time had a great track record. They jumped aggressively into the home refinance world, the home equity loan world, because the sky was the limit. You know, why don't we find their tactic was, let's find people who are carrying a lot of credit card debt but own equity in their home, and let's convince them to take these loans. We'll charge 15-18%. These people have bad credit histories anyway. They're subprime customers. Let's get them to refinance using their home as collateral. And meanwhile, borrowing money at a 15% rate with, you know, 6% fee on the top just to create the loan in the first place, a lot of people got hurt. A lot of people lost homes. A lot of people took loans that they couldn't afford that put them into a much deeper hole than the hole that Household was supposedly going to help them out of.
And Lewis, then bring us to the 90s. You write about what happened then, and at that time, anyone really could get a credit card, not just people with money.
Yeah, just to build on what he was saying, that the idea, one of the transformative moment things that changed in this moment was that they lent to people they expected would not be able to pay them back. Mm-hmm. So they started to use statistics. They started to say, what is the expected rate of repayment, the expected rate of default? And if in the post-war period they wanted everybody to pay them back every cent and they lent to people they expected to pay them back, by the 1980s and 90s, they were lending to people they expected to fail. And that is something that we need to consider, that maybe we shouldn't allow them to lend to people they expect to fail at some above a certain rate. So in the 90s, what happens is you start to have more and more people have access to credit cards, and it's easier to get them because they have access now to the capital markets. So you can borrow, you can basically lend money to somebody and then sell it into the capital markets. And it allows companies to be able to lend enormous amounts of money that they themselves don't have.
Well, I'd love to hear from listeners on this. How has the economic crisis changed the way you deal with credit? How much debt do you have? And what has your experience been like? Are you and people around you spending because there's more money, or is it because you have no choice but to put the basics on your credit card? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. How has your relationship with debt really changed over the last 10 or so years? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. We've got an email from Debbie who says, I've been trying to get a home loan for the past 6 months to renovate my home, but the banks won't approve me. However, the credit card company owned by the same bank will give me $30,000 right now, interest-free, for an entire year. Lewis, how common is this?
I think it's pretty common because lenders do not think about the whole of someone's financial life. For instance, in the 1990s, one of the reasons it became so easy to borrow for credit cards was that people were able to pay back what they borrowed from home equity loans. So people took money out of their house and paid back their credit card debts. So that it looked like that people were paying out of their incomes when they were really paying out of the rising value of their assets. And so people were able to borrow so much more. And lenders thought of people not as someone who has an array of debts, an array of assets, but really just looking at these very small metrics. So they look at Debbie's income, they look at Debbie's how long she's lived at a certain job, and they say, nope, her house isn't worth enough. We won't give her that depending on this income. But they look at her income and they say, oh, well, for a credit card, that's a different question. And so they're able to lend, they want to lend to her. And so people are not seen holistically. They're seen as these little bits and pieces that sometimes don't add up.
Yeah, you know, and to add to what Lewis was saying, I agree to everything he said, but there is another factor, and not that the banks are necessarily thinking of it, but I don't think it's a coincidence that on a home equity loan, what would that be, 5, 6, 7% interest a year APR right now, as opposed to whatever your listener is carrying on a credit card. I mean, typically someone's going to pay 12-15% on the low side, 20-30% APR on the higher side, with potentially more if it's a particularly egregious credit card annual fee. So it might make no sense in the way Lewis put it. However, somehow it makes perfect sense to the bottom line for the banks.
And it does make sense. Yeah, I completely agree. And it's a difference in the interest rate that matters so much, right? That she's thinking of it as, I'm a borrower, the bank wants to give me money. But the truth is, it's an investment by the bank, and they want to get the highest rate of return for their dollar. And so that's what they're trying to do.
And so we're talking 30% on the high side? I had no idea it was so high. What's the average right now, Gary?
Yeah, I can't tell you what the average is, but I do know, there's people who have very good credit, and there's people who have poor credit. I mean, one of the really interesting things that's happened, I'm sure Lewis gets into this, into his book, which sounds great, by the way, sitting on my desk.
Oh, thanks.
By coincidence, can't wait to delve in. What changed is, once it wasn't about necessarily paying back the bills, but just you could make a profit. It was just so easy for anyone to get credit. I write a lot about payday loans, but even credit cards. They came up with the subprime credit card, and a few intrepid entrepreneurs said, something? I'm going to target the very people who the big banks are turning down for credit cards. Because I think I have a way of making this work financially. And, lo and behold, they did. And they were making two and a half times the profit on every one of their subprime credit card customers as the conventional banks were making with their conventional customers. And so then when you saw it happen, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, a long list of big brand-name banks, got into the subprime credit card business. So anybody could get a credit card. And, yes, if you're carrying a subprime credit card, if you don't have very good credit, or if you got snuck into a subprime not realizing that you could get a better deal given your FICO score, your credit score, they are paying 25, 30, 35%. I don't know what portion of the people are. Do you, Lewis?
I don't know the portion, but I know 100% of people with bad FICO scores are paying too much.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that's the important thing to realize. It's also important to realize that every dollar that gets invested by a bank in credit card debt is a dollar that is not used for something else. Mm-hmm. It's a dollar that's not invested in small business. It's a dollar that's not invested in productive enterprises, which I think, as I argue in the book, is really strangling the economy.
Thank you for the email, Debbie. We have another comment from Ede, who says, the credit card business did not exist in the same way in the 60s and 70s. He says it's now forced on us. You cannot rent a car or a hotel room, for example, without a credit card. Can you please comment on that? Lewis, what changes have you seen over the decades on this one?
Oh, absolutely. The credit card business in the 60s and 70s was the province of traveling businessmen for the most part. Mm-hmm. If we differentiate, we're talking about bank run business cards and also diners club and other travel and entertainment cards. But there were charge accounts at department stores that and other kinds of local retailers that were widely used all the time by consumers. But it certainly was the case that cash was king, and you were able to borrow things. You were able to rent cars and get hotel rooms and verify your identity without using a credit card. Whereas today, there's something almost illicit about cash, that it has the tinge of a drug trade about it in a way that credit cards do not. You can verify someone's identity, and I think that's a tremendous shift over the last few decades.
And I think Ede makes a great point that we're, in just 40 or 50 years, it's such a profound transformation that, as the professor just said, it used to be business people had in their pockets, and the typical person didn't. It was harder to get, and it wasn't as common a thing for everyone to think about. And exactly, today try buying something on the internet, you can't. I mean, just as Ede just said, you can't get a car, it's hard to get a hotel room with just cash.
Well, thank you for that email, Ede, and let's hear from a caller, Rosa in Palo Alto. Hi, Rosa.
Hi.
Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. So I definitely agree. I think that credit card, if abused, can be very dangerous. But for me, I have kind of an interesting story. So basically, I graduated from college, and I had a job set up. And I quit my part-time job, and I was getting ready to move to the city. And then probably about got probably a week before the job ship started. They called me and they said Rosa, funding fell through, and so we have to, we can't hire you. And so at that point, I had pretty much quit my job, and I didn't have any money. And the reason that I wasn't going back home was because I really wanted to kind of lay down my role as an independent person. And so I decided to apply for a credit card, and I was unemployed for about 2 months, and I used that credit card to pay for my food and bills. And to this day, I still say that credit card saved my life. It allowed me to pay for things that I couldn't have because I didn't have the cash. And I paid it off eventually after I got a job. But that's just what I wanted to say.
And what was your interest rate? And how much debt did you actually accumulate?
My interest rate was 13%.
Okay. And so did you accumulate a lot of debt before you were able to pay it off?
I think the credit card limit was like $3,000, but within the 3 months, I used about $800, and I wasn't able to pay it off all at once. But I paid it off once I finally landed on my feet and I got a job. I paid off the entire thing probably in like 2-3 months, and I probably paid a couple $100 extra, but. To me, I say it was worth it.
Yeah, well, thank you for calling, Rosa. I'm sure there are a lot of people out there in the same situation. Gary, what are your thoughts on this?
First off, I could testify myself.
Yeah.
There was a period in my life where I was able to keep it together using a credit card. I mean, it's a useful tool. It's a dangerous tool. But I think the point to make here is that there's a hierarchy of debt. Let's say the average credit card carries an 18% annual percentage rate. Well, there's the payday loan, which from one of these shops you would find, a payday loan shop in California, you'd be paying fees that work out to 400% a year. Wells Fargo is one of the big banks that offers their own version of a payday loan. They don't call it that, but it's a short-term advance for an emergency against your paycheck. And they're charging like fees that work out to 200, 250% annual interest. You go to the rent-to-own store because you can't afford a bedroom set. You've just, you split from your spouse. You need to kind of set up on your own. You could put it on your credit card and spend $700 for that bedroom set, plus a little bit of interest, or you can go to the local renter center, and they'll charge you over 18 months, $1,500, $1,600, $1,700. So I could come up with all sorts of scenarios where a credit card is a very wise tool to use, largely because there's far more abusive versions of credit that are out there.
And I think if I could add to that
sure.
a little, I think Rosa's story is a good one because it turned out as she expected. Even though she had some reversal when she first got to the city, she was there trying to follow the rules, trying to find a job, and she was employable. She wasn't able to get her job, but she was employable, and it turned out she was able to find a job, and I'd like to say congratulations to that.
Yes.
But it's not true. It's not true for everyone, and it's hard to reason from just anecdotes. For instance, if she were not so young and so flexible, $800 over the course of 3 months doesn't sound like a lot to me, particularly if you have a few kids and you're in your 40s or 50s and you lose your job and you don't get unemployment benefits and you put it all on the cards and you, like Rosa, expect to find a job in a few months, but suddenly you don't.
Right.
You're not employable, and you build up that credit, and because you are older and have paid your bills for most of your life and followed the rules.
And Lewis,
you have a $30,000 limit, so it can really get out of hand very quickly.
Sorry to cut you off. We have to go to break. We'd love to hear from you on credit card debt. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
San Francisco. High school students all around the Bay Area pursuing careers in finance, information technology, and biotech are looking for summer internship opportunities. If you'd like to make a real contribution to the future of these students, you can find out how to get involved at kalw.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can leave a comment there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about the hypersexualization of women and girls in the media. We'll talk about the documentary Misrepresentation that looks at the portrayal of women and girls in pop culture and also the lack of women in critical leadership roles. How are these trends affecting our society? How have they affected you? And how should we respond to this? Thursday, we'll be talking about Occupy Education, the March 1st rally that is happening. We'll be talking to students about the time at which they became radicalized. We'll be speaking with one UC Davis student who was pepper sprayed back in October, and we'd love to hear from you. At what point did you become radicalized? That's on Thursday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about consumer debt. According to the Federal Reserve, Americans owe $2.5 trillion in consumer debt. The average American has about $15,000 in credit card debt alone. So where do you fit in on this? How has your relationship with credit cards and debt really changed in the last decade? How has it changed from the economic crisis? How much debt do you carry? And what is your interest rate, just out of curiosity? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can leave a comment at yourcallradio.org so others can see it. And we're joined today by Lewis Hyman, Assistant Professor of History in Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations. He's out with a new book, Borrow, The American Way of Debt. We're also joined by Gary River, special correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. He's the author of five books, including Broke USA, From Pawn Shops to Poverty, Inc., How the Working Poor Became Big Business. And I'd like to read a couple of emails. Robert writes, I suspect that I'm not alone in receiving daily harassing collection calls for debts and people I have no connection to. He says it's Kafkaesque. Gary, you've been looking into these debt collectors. Oh, is this common that people get harassing collection calls from companies they don't have connections with?
It's remarkably common. I mean, you at the start of the show said that where there used to be 1 in 14 people who were being chased by a debt collector, it's now 1 in 7. It's doubled since 2000. Well, since 2002, the number of complaints to the FTC about debt collectors has tripled. And just in the last year alone, from 2009 to 2010, the complaints about debt collectors threatening violence has gone up by 66%.
Violence?
And the most pernicious element is what the email writer is getting at, which is, and some people don't even owe it. I really made it my business to find people who are in what is called the debt buyer business. I mean, after a while, the hospital gets tired of calling people up looking for their money, so they sell the debt. By law, a credit card company, a bank with a credit card, can't hold your bad debt, in most cases, more than 6 months. And so they sell it to someone else. And so there's this whole industry of debt buyers out there. And what makes it particularly insidious is they sell it and resell it and resell it and resell it again. In fact, it's such a common practice that there's name. It's warehouse debt is debt so old that they stop counting, but there's third generation debt, fourth generation debt, and they all kind of use that lingo. And talking to the debt collectors who are charged with collecting and talking to the debt buyers who buy it, some of them admit that in 1 in 10 cases, one woman said, a debt collector, maybe 1 in 5 cases, they have wrong information. Because you can imagine this debt that Bank of America, that you owed to Bank of America in 2006, they sell it, and maybe the person bothered to pay extra for the records. Often they don't pay extra for the records for obvious reasons, make more money. And then the person who bought it for Bank of America sells it to someone else, and a second, a third, a fourth. And eventually, there's just no records. And what anyone listening should do is, if you get a call, you immediately say, give me the address, I need to write to you, and you demand to see the records that substantiates the amount of money you supposedly owe. And they, by law, need to do that. So what happens is somebody makes that threat, they don't hear from the person again, they think it's the it's done with. 6 months, 10 months passes. They haven't heard from the debt collector. And lo and behold, now their phone starts ringing again, and it's a whole new debt collector, and you have to go through it again. It's an utter mess. It just destroys it. It really intrudes on people's lives. I actually tracked down some people this had happened to. And it's almost like there's no stopping. I mean, I guess the good news here is the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which just opened its doors in July, has declared that the debt collection industry is one of its main priorities, and they do have the power to write new regulations, write new rules dictating what debt collectors can and can't do.
Okay, because that was my next question. Is this industry regulated at all?
Every state has its own set of rules regulating debt collectors and debt buyers. California is a little bit more progressive than other places, but you know, it's very specific. You can only call once or twice a day. You can only call between. There was a national law in the late 1970s that created a set of rules that you cannot call before, I think it's 8:30 in the morning until 9 o'clock or so at night. And so they create a series of rules like this, but, you know, two things: that still leaves a lot of wiggle room. They could call you 100 times in between those hours, depending on what state they're in. Huh. Some states put a limit on that. Some states don't. But beyond that, the real problem is the they call it zombie debt, this debt that doesn't die, that you don't even really owe, or you owe, but you owe from so long ago, it's not even legal to collect on it anymore, or they have no legal right to collect on it anymore.
Well, thank you for the email, Robert, and good luck in dealing with the phone calls. And we've got a number of callers on the line. Let's hear from William in Belvedere. Hi, William. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you. Excuse me. Yes, thank you very much. There's one aspect that has not been touched upon. And you related to something, Rose, when you said that the average consumer has $16,000 in credit card debt. But I'd like the guests to say if they know. For instance, if I have $3,000 at the end of my billing period, I pay it off all the time. You know, at
right.
the end of it, I don't know anything on it. And yet, I guess if someone were to figure out the average, and say it was that I would have $3,000. Do you understand what I'm saying? But it's paid off all the time. And for those of us who do pay it off all the time, it's a great convenience because, for instance, we can get frequent flyer miles and then take an airplane trip, or we can get a kind of a card where they give you back a certain percentage of what you buy. So for some people, obviously, it has developed into a terrible problem. They may be using the credit card because they have no other income, et cetera.
Right.
I certainly recognize that, but it is an advantage for other people, and I'd like to know from the guests what percentage of people just use it as that kind of convenience.
Yeah, it's a good question. What are your thoughts on that, Lewis?
Well, freeloaders like you, as they're called in the industry, or non-revolvers, are generally not categorized alongside the people. So usually when you see those numbers like 15,000, they are discussing people who roll their debt over from month to month. And of course, these numbers change over time. So the composition, most people were like that in 1980, and now most people are not like that today. So there it changes over time what the composition is. And I don't know the current numbers, but certainly people who our revolvers are much more profitable than people who are not revolvers. And this is exactly the problem we see for the industry with debit cards, right? This is why all the companies want to raise the fees on debit cards. And then people like the caller feel like they are being punished for being moral, right? For paying off their debts every month and doing the right thing. But in fact, they are exactly what banks and other lenders do not want. They want someone to pay them money every month. And so it's a problem because they want to keep lending you money until you, in fact, cannot pay it back
right.
every month.
And I think what's really important here is there are a lot of freeloaders, and yet if the average consumer is carrying $15,000 of debt and our caller is carrying zero, that $3,000 that he
exactly.
pays right away doesn't count. You know, start thinking about it. How much does the average person who actually is carrying debt, how much debt is that person carrying? Because the $15,000 includes people like our caller who owe nothing.
Right. Well, thank you for calling in, William. That was a good point. And let's go to our next caller, Linda in Southern Oregon. Hi, Linda. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I wonder if your guests could comment on what I guess is called people-to-people loans. Now that if you have savings in the bank, you're making like less than 1% interest, and it seems like people might want to lend to other people. In fact, I have looked online, like, is there a community kind of thing where you could lend to people? But the people-to-people things that I've seen online have fairly high interest rates, too, and I just wondered if your guests had any information on community-based, I guess you'd call it private lending. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so I used to be stationed out there in Silicon Valley covering technology, so why don't I jump on this? I feel like that's all really interesting stuff, but it's in its infancy. And, you know, it's the same problem that any lender would have. How do you know this is a good bet? How do you know that lending this stranger via the Internet, that this person is going to pay back? There are certain things, you know, what's their credit score? There's ways of testing just like a bank or any lender would test. But we're in the early stages. But interesting in the world I know pretty well, payday lending. So the payday lenders are charging 400% interest on these short-term loans. You would think that businesses could come in and figure out how to do it smarter and charge much less. And we're starting to see that in Silicon Valley, that startups are actually conquering or trying to conquer what I call the poverty business, using technology, using their smarts and entrepreneurial spirit to take this on. But even then, I've come across some companies that are charging a very reasonable APR of 28%, 36% per year. But I'm coming across companies, one, you know, a former guy from Google started, and they're charging 100, 150% interest.
Wow.
So it's sort of buyer beware. Mm.
And I think the important thing to point out is that it's about this risk. It's about the information. It's this statistical way of thinking about people. And always they are going to be more expensive than people who can, than lenders like banks who can lend to hundreds, thousands of people. They can smooth out that risk over all the people who are borrowing. But if you're on Kickstarter or Kiva or any of these other great things, it's just too risky. So the rates are going to be higher. And then alternatively, you could go to credit unions, which are ostensibly nonprofit, but because they're nonprofit, they don't make money by definition, so mm-hmm. they can't grow. So these kinds of things, while they're interesting, they're at the periphery, and I think are fundamentally not important compared to the main sources of capital in our economy, which are securitization and the banks.
All right. Thank you for the call, Linda. Today we are talking about consumer debt. The average American has about $15,000 in credit card debt alone, although based on the call we got from William, there are a lot of us who maybe charge a couple grand a month and pay it off on time, and we are called freeloaders. Lewis, where did that term freeloader come from?
It came from the frustration of credit card companies in the 1970s with people who would do exactly that, who would pay off their loans every month, and they hoped to make money off them, and they were not able to do so.
And by the way, can I cut in the magic of the Internet? So while we were all talking, I looked up some stats. Slightly more than half of the people, 51%, said that in the past 12 months, they've carried a balance that they charged interest on.
Okay.
So about half the people are carrying a balance, at least for a part of the year.
And that's what they tell people. So I
right.
suspect it's actually more, because these things are these things are always imbued with these moral qualities, right? I'm sure that many callers feel very proud of themselves for paying off their loans every month, and rightly they should.
Right.
But I think it's also that it's something that we're ashamed of.
And that is Lewis Hyman, Assistant Professor of History in Cornell's School of Industrial and Labor Relations. He's author of Borrow, The American Way of Debt. Gary Rivlin is a special correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. He is author of Broke USA, From Pawn Shops to Poverty, Inc., How the Working Poor Became Big Business. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. We'd love to hear your story about your relationship with debt and credit cards. How has it changed over the course of the economic crisis? You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Everett in Santa Cruz. Hi, Everett. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I just had a quick comment, really, just about you know, the fact that credit cards have given me an opportunity to purchase things otherwise outside of my budget, you know. You know, 0% interest, it seems a lot of credit card companies are offering this to me, balance transfers and things like this, and I've actually been able to utilize that with some success. I haven't paid very much interest at all, and, you know, I think that it's a tool that, if used correctly, can help people maybe that don't make as much money or have access to certain things have more access.
Right. Well, you're lucky that you have a 0% interest.
Yeah, I guess I'm kind of one of those freeloaders, but, you know, I'm kind of banking on holding on to a job and, you know, being able to make these payments. And I know that if that fell through, that there's interest that comes along with that. So
right.
It's kind of a gamble, but something that, you know, I'm 27. I've been able to use, you know, pretty well. So
yeah. All right. Well, thanks for calling, Everett.
Well, he has a teaser rate. He has a teaser rate of zero that will reset depending on what deal, 6 months, 8 months, a year. And going back to my little stat sheet I found here, according to Pew, 3/4 of the cars that have a low promotional rate, I mean, they're usually not as low as 0%, but, you know, a 2%, 5% if you transfer your balance now. 3/4 of them, if you're late a single time, it immediately resets. A single late payment will mean you're immediately reset and paying, right here it says that the average interest rate on a credit card is 15%.
And this is the thing also, that he's able to do it while he has a job, which,
right.
You know,
right.
I think it's very important to bring these things back to that, because that's the essential question. So that in the post-war period, when all these things were developed, it was you could expect to keep your job in the future. And I don't think that any of us are as confident about our future employment today, that labor markets are much more volatile. And what he's doing is taking that risk on himself. So that the risk, if he goes unemployed, then he will start to borrow money. And he's also taking the risk that if he loses his job, he'll be able to somehow get another job again in the future. And these two things are very connected.
And speaking of losing a job, we have an email from a listener who says, in 2009, my daughter and son-in-law lost what they thought were secure teaching jobs in Texas, a state which does not allow public service unions. They decided to come back to California, asked if they could live with me while they get back on their feet. They stayed with me for about 18 months, and only one of them was working part-time. My son-in-law found full-time work, though not in his field, and they were able to move back. I am now steadily paying down the $30,000 I accrued because of having to support four people on a lecturer's salary for almost 2 years. I hope to be out of debt within 2 to 3 years. Lecturers make on average about half of what a tenure track professor with equivalent experience makes. I did not blow out the plastic on travel or expensive dining. Even my financial advisor agreed that my reasons for using credit cards had been justified.
So, right. I mean, getting back to the point we talked about a little before, that often you have no choice.
Right.
I mean, I think in a lot of people's minds, it's like, well, if those people would just stop buying so many flat screen TVs or expensive toys they can't afford. Because again, that happens. It's happened and all. But increasingly, we're talking about people putting basic expenses on their credit cards. I've done it. Pretty much every person I know has done it. And you know, there's an element of huge risk here, because if you lose the job, if the kid staying for 2 months turns into 18 months and turns into a $30,000 bill, you know, that's a really hard hole to get out of. First rule, if you're in a hole, stop digging. But if you can't stop, you got to eat, you got to pay your rent.
Right.
You know, you have these expenses.
And these are people who went to college. These are people who got teaching jobs, which are supposed to be very secure. And it's not as if they are just living an exciting life of Riley. They were doing what they were supposed to do, and then suddenly, because of forces beyond their control, they lost their jobs. And again, I think lecturers, you know, she probably has a PhD, and she spent most of her 20s and possibly her 30s in school getting a good education. And then, lo and behold, most professor jobs these days are adjunct positions that do not pay well at all, that pay about $20,000 to $30,000 a year.
Wow.
And those are the majority of the professors who are teaching all the students in America who are then racking up the debt. Mm. So it's part of the whole system.
And we're talking about credit cards, but let's go to the class below. Let's talk about people making $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year, have a couple of kids. They're taking out payday loans. And the same phenomena happens. Your car breaks down. You need to get to work, and of course it makes economic sense to take the quick $300 loan so you could fix your car And even though it has a huge fee, $45 for 2 weeks on that $300, you do it. But then how do you have the extra $345 in 2 weeks when it comes due? Well, you don't. The average person takes 2 or 3 months to pay one of these back, so they're not paying $15 per every 100. They're paying $45, $60, $75 per 100. The average person taking out a payday loan owes 12 or 13 of these a year. One out of five people has it out always. I mean, they have 20 plus in the course of a year, and so it's not even a theoretical interest rate of 400%. They're paying $400 in fees on every $100 they buy because they get in this trap. I mean, these are very risky products. That was the whole idea behind the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Elizabeth Warren, whose idea it was, said if you have a toaster in your home, a $20 item, there is protection. There's the consumer organization, a consumer agency in Washington paying attention to it. But these $200,000, $500,000 mortgages, these payday loans, all these other dangerous financial products, there's no agency that's paying attention from the consumer's point of view, protecting the consumers, and that's what gave rise to Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. These are all, well, most of these are good tools that we could use, but they're also dangerous tools that, if nothing else, we need to be.
And we're almost out of time, but I wanted to spend more time on this, but unfortunately, we're almost out. We'll talk a little bit about how many companies we're talking about here and lobbying. So, for example, Visa is a great example. Most people I know have a Visa card. They just posted net income for the 3 months ending December. It rose to $1 billion from $884 million. This time last year. So we're talking a 16% increase in their net income. This year alone, Visa gave $211,000 to politicians, 48% to Democrats, 52% to Republicans. Gary, we don't have much time, but what really stands out for you in terms of lobbying power of these companies?
We hear from the banks they're going through hard times. We hear from the banks that they're losing all these ways to make money. But there's one fact that they can't argue with, that in 2010, they set a record for the amount of money that the banks collectively spent on lobbyists. And in 2011, after the passage of Dodd-Frank, they spent even more to try to undo some of the bills or to forestall its implementation. And that is like $60, $65 million they spent collectively on lobbyists in 2011. And that doesn't even include the $100 million or so that the big investment banks, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, they're spending on lobbyists. It really is astonishing the amount of money that's being given, being spent on lobbyists. And then there's the amount of money that they're spending on campaign contributions. Wall Street is not very happy with Barack Obama for Dodd-Frank, and they're giving millions, tens of millions of dollars, I'm sure, by the time Election Day comes, to various candidates who are opposing financial reform.
And what makes this all possible is that all that money that the 1% is making, you know, to use the language of our times, that all that money that is being concentrated at the top, that is not being paid down in wages, has to be invested somewhere. So it's not just a few companies, it's the investors behind those companies, not just in America but abroad. It's global capitalism. And it's people at that huge pile of money at the top. They're willing to lend to people at the bottom, but they're not willing to pay them wages.
And you point out that they're not willing to lend to small businesses.
Yeah, in my book, I talk a lot about this, about how there has been a crowding out of small business loans by these consumer loans, so that what reasonable person would lend a small business loan to somebody who would only earn 5 or 6% and be very risky as an individual business compared to investing in consumer debt, which has a lower risk and a higher return. So the very policies we've created to enable securitization of consumer loans have crowded out business loans,
right,
for small business, even while those big companies are able to buy and sell debt every day.
Well, Open Secrets put together a nice list of how much companies like American Express and MasterCard are giving to politicians, and we'll put a link at yourcallradio.org, as well as information about their massive profits. Let's take one more call. Let's hear from Debbie in Santa Cruz. Hi, Debbie.
Hi. Well, you had asked about what my experience is. I will tell you my story, and then I'll tell you first off that I don't have any credit card debt. I never want to go there again.
And we're almost out of time, so if you can be kind of brief, that would be great.
Okay. All right, so basically I used to make a lot of money, and I made it in bulk, and I had twice before
charged up my credit cards to $150,000. Had a nice rush, was able to pay it all down. I was in real estate and real estate loans. And then this last time, I wasn't able to do that. And it was just really sad that I now I have a regular job and I have a simpler life, but I have roommates now. I had to go through loan modifications, and it was just a horrible experience. And I wonder what would have happened if I wouldn't have had that available to me.
Hmm. Well, thank you for your story, Debbie. Another common one, Lewis?
Another common story, and again, I think it comes back to the uncertainty of the future. It's the fact that we are making choices based on the idea that our life will continue as it is. And in this more volatile economy, that is not true.
And with a home equity loan, using your house as collateral for a loan, you put your home at risk. I mean, with a credit card, yes, you'll have harassing phone calls, but you won't be putting your home at risk. And I think that's something that people lost their head about right before the bursting of the bubble. In the 2000s, you just saw a skyrocketing percentage increase in home equity loans. And I talked to some bankruptcy attorneys, and the people who were making them, a large portion of them, including teachers, well-educated people, didn't understand that by taking a home equity loan, you're putting your home at risk.
And we're almost out of time. Lewis, just quickly, do you think that this might be a bubble that could possibly burst consumer debt?
I think it's a bubble because there's no alternative, because there's no place to invest the money at the right risk and return. So I think we need to figure out ways to create not just a stick in terms of regulating lending to consumers, but a carrot, like we've done in many different ways in the past, to draw money back into investment in businesses and productive enterprises.
Lewis Hyman is author of Borrow, the American Way of Debt, and Gary Rivlin is author of Broke USA. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
And thanks for your phone calls and emails. Thanks for sharing all your personal stories. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. How should we respond to the hypersexualization of women and girls in the media? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about misrepresentation, a documentary about the increasingly sexualized portrayals of women and girls in pop culture. The film also looks at the lack of women in critical leadership roles. So how are these trends affecting our society, especially youth? How do they affect you and those around you? And how should we respond to this? It's Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. And Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.